Hello and welcome to European Urbanism. This episode is in English due to my guests Dr. Garrick and Dr. Minster. Without much further ado, have fun and enjoy the show.
So I'm Norman Garrick. I am a professor of transportation engineering at the University of Connecticut. But presently I am on sabbatical leave and I'm spending a year at the ETH.
And what do you do at the sabbatical? I mean, you don't sleep in all day.
Well, sabbatical leave is really to take, it's to learn and to be in a different environment. For me, that's how I see it. I mean, it's been some of the most important turning points in my career. So, for example, the first time I went on sabbatical, I lived in Cambridge, UK.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was a really big turning point because I changed career essentially.
Okay.
I changed from being a pavement engineer to a transportation and urban planner. And that was from the experience of living in Cambridge and living in a place where lots of people rode their bikes and took transit. And this was a very different experience from living in a US city.
So you are from the University of Connecticut?
Yes.
And they don't, you know, take the bike or something like this, like it's normal?
It's getting more common. Okay. But in 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I started there, it was very, very traditional. Almost everybody drove. There was lots of parking. But the university over the years have changed how we use transportation. For example, when I first started there, everybody parked on campus for free. Now you have to pay. And in fact, I started to change my behavior. I used to drive to work. And when I started having to pay $1,000 per year, I stopped driving and I realized that I actually enjoyed walking. So, you know, the institutional structure was really important in terms of my own personal behavior.
Was it a problem when they put in place these parking requirements, or was it just an easy process for the administration? Because I know parking is such a high emotional...
Parking is a huge deal, yes. I did a video a few years ago about Zurich, which has very progressive parking policies. And then I was talking about the fact that even there, parking is a huge deal. But the university made the changes, and there were complaints, but they ignored them. I think the typical thing with universities is that they realize that people are there for 4 years, so you can just ride out the wave of complaints, and that's how the university dealt with it.
At the KIT, we have free parking, but it's restricted, so students can't go on the campus with their cars, and even for personnel, it's restricted extremely because we don't have the space.
Yeah.
We can't build a parking.
But it sounds unequitable then. So who gets free parking?
It depends if you're handicapped person,
right,
or cars off the university, naturally, and then there are professors naturally have parking.
That sends a really bad message, doesn't it? It's like there is this special class of people. So therefore, parking is a privilege that is given to a special class of people, and everybody else doesn't get it. I mean, the message that sends is horrifically bad.
Well, it used to be like that, and they started it pretty early on.
Yeah.
So it's the way it is at the moment.
Yeah.
Of course, there's pressure to get more parking.
Yeah.
And especially in the campus north, it's this way that we have enough space so you can get in there.
Yeah.
But in the city, it's different. And then the next thing is you have to consider it's culture, which means we have extremely good public transport. We have, since they started in 2004, we have much better biking policy in Karlsruhe. So we have now, we are about 25% of the modal split is a bike ride, so it's not that much of pressure.
Right.
We actually have a problem with the bike parking now, which we are on to get it fixed, the problem, but it's in general, it's in car parking, we can't do anything anymore.
Right.
And we do have parking spaces in garages where the people can go if they want to, but they have to pay.
Right.
So, but we can't change it because we just don't have the space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's I'm shocked to hear that there is free parking on the campus in the middle of the city. I mean, I would never have guessed that in this day and age that a university is doing that. Given that you changed your name from University of Karlsruhe to KIT to emulate MIT, MIT would never have free parking on their campus.
Okay, so you have to pay there. Good to know. Get something to say when we have to change policy eventually, which we don't at the moment, but it's in the background. No, I think it's generally, you think everywhere that parking should be free, and it isn't. It's not. You have
well, it's never free. I mean, some people might not pay, but somebody's always paying to provide parking.
Yeah, definitely.
And one of the things that people get surprised at is the cost of building a parking space.
Yeah.
And in the US, it's up to $80,000 for one space.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it's not free.
I know it's not free. And I'm just starting to pull together the numbers to what it actually costs to just give the people and the personnel and the students, you know, a figure that they know it isn't free. Anyway, we've also got Dr. Minster here, so maybe you can say something about you.
My name is Katja Minster. I'm working at the Institute for Transport Studies here at KIT. I'm a researcher and I'm also a lecturer in urban planning.
You sound French, so how did you get? How did you get here to Karlsruhe?
Actually, I'm French, and I came to Karlsruhe after my PhD. I completed my PhD in France, and then I decided to go abroad. And I already knew Karlsruhe, and I already went to Karlsruhe and to KIT. In my young time, it was still the University of Karlsruhe. So, I decided to come back.
Okay.
I'm very happy with it.
You have a background as city planner?
Exactly. I'm a geographer and urban planner.
So I was asking myself, where are the differences in Europe and America?
Well, I think the difference is not so much one of kind, but is more one of amount.
Mm-hmm.
So in America, we are much more car oriented.
Okay.
Whereas here in Germany, you're only somewhat car oriented, but still too car oriented. Yeah, so it's really a difference of where you are on the scale. Living in Zurich, I realize what a city that is really, that focuses on pedestrians and public transportation, what it is like, how it differs. And coming here is another kind of shock to the system, because this city is not really all that walkable or pedestrian friendly in comparison to the Zurich. And so it's interesting, the contrast. If I'd come here from America, I would think, oh, this is a really nice walkable city. But coming here from Zurich, I feel quite different.
For me as a German, to hear that we aren't car-oriented or not as much is quite funny, because we always think Germany is extremely car-oriented because we've got the manufacturers.
I think you are extremely car-oriented. Yeah. The only thing is that we have America to compare you to. That makes a big difference.
Yeah.
So when I first came to Europe this year, I came from Amsterdam. So I traveled through Zurich to get through Germany to get to Zurich. And you can imagine Amsterdam and Zurich compared to Germany. It's like, wow.
What is your experience? Have you been to America, or would you, if you're from France, is that very different to Germany, or?
I'm not sure. I speak under your control, but maybe I will say that the difference between European cities and American cities is also the place of history. Because in Europe, at least in France, we have a really long history, and we are keeping this history in our cities. And I didn't saw that in the American cities I visited, but that's not all. But I'm not sure if it's really relevant.
It is relevant, but it's complicated, because in Germany, I've seen so many of your cities were destroyed.
Yeah, I was thinking.
So that break with history is also relevant. And they are American cities that are really, I mean, history for us is different, but still they are pre-car cities in America. So it's complicated. And I think in places like France and Italy, what is really horrific there is the suburbs, is how the suburbs have evolved in those places. And I think in a way that is really not very nice.
Yeah. I only know in Italy, the inner cities, so I don't know, are the suburbs, so are they sprawled?
Well, they might not be sprawling, but they are. In France, certainly in Paris, a lot of the suburbs are where poor people live, in a lot of high rises.
Yeah, it's depend of the suburbs.
Yeah.
But in France, we have a lot of really monofunctional suburbs, mm-hmm. and also really segregated suburbs. And we have an history, and a lot of buildings were built in the after World War II. After World War II, and now these suburbs are really poor, with a lot of social and economical problems. But it's around the big cities, so Paris, where the most problems are concentrated.
But I think it's after the war, it totally depended on the view of the point of the architects and the city planners. I think there was in Germany, I come from Leipzig, and I know in the east of Germany, most of the old buildings were rebuilt.
Right.
While in the western Germany, they built new buildings, which you see in the architecture, which I really don't like. But anyway, Karlsruhe is nice. So I think it's also depending on the view the architects took, and they thought at least in the 1950s and 1960s that they could create a kind of new different type of city, and that they could make living better. They had this utopian idea, and I think Le Corbusier had some ideas, though at the moment, and now looking back at it, we don't think, oh god, no it's horrible, but it does have some impact, I think so. But when I was to America, it was really interesting because you have this idea of America, and when I came to San Francisco, I was completely shocked, because as soon as you leave the banking district, you have overhead landlines for electricity and stuff like this, something you don't see anymore in Germany. Do you recognize this?
That's an interesting thing, because it's so much a part of the American cityscape that you don't really notice it. But there's a funny story when they were trying to reinstate trolleys in Washington, D.C. The biggest objection was to the overhead wires. And I'm like, there's so many things already going on the streets of Washington, and people are objecting. They're saying that this is not historically correct. So we had to find a different solutions, like putting the electric power into the ground, which, of course, that is nightmarish to think about. But, you know, it was such a foolish idea. But in America, it's a big problem that we have these overhead wires, not just because of how they look, but, for example, where I live, there's been times when we've been without power for a week or more because of storms.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You're always reading about the power outages in the American grid. It's really...
Yes, it's really about a cheap... I mean, a lot of stuff in America is about how do you get stuff done as cheaply as possible. And that one is certainly an example.
Thinking about Paris, I know you have an underground, but I don't think you have trams.
We start in Paris. There are some trams.
Okay.
Yeah. We have trams, we have underground.
But public transport is used in France.
Public transport is used in the case of Paris. Well, Paris is not representative for the rest of France.
Okay.
But in the case of Paris, it's really used. And it's also quite interesting because the funding also depend from the companies being in Paris. So that's the funding of the public transport is quite interesting. And this system that does not exist in other countries as far as I know.
How does it differ, the system? Is it not publicly maintained? So it's not a city budget or something like this? Or?
It's definitely a city budget, but you also have what we call le versement transport. And there is that means a transport contribution, and it's companies contributing to public transport.
Voluntarily, or are they required? They're required on what basis? The size of the company?
The size, the number of employees.
Okay.
I think they have something like this now in Vienna, too. I think they have. The companies have to pay there too, for depending how good they are.
Okay, I never heard of that. That's interesting. So it's more like a tax on a public transportation tax.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. In France, definitely a tax. On the company.
Yeah, I think so. And Vienna it has this. They did this, and they have also the company owns also the garages, the parking houses.
Yeah.
So they wanted to get the people to use more public transport, so they made the parking
more expensive. Yeah.
And in a bigger percentage of this parking, the money that came in, the revenue was pulled toward the public transport, and so they could finance it better and make it cheaper to use it for the inhabitants.
And you said this is Vienna.
Vienna.
So
yes.
In the French case, is it a national policy or is it a city policy?
It's an urban policy
for the whole country.
Most. And
what is administered at the national level, or
no? It's companies having at least 11 salaries, employees.
Yeah,
have to pay this transport tax, and it was started in Paris when Paris wanted to build the RER, so the express subway.
Yeah,
we needed more funding, and it was the idea that, and the main idea is that companies benefit from a good public transportation system, so they have to contribute to it.
Yeah, I think that's the same way they did it in Vienna.
Yeah.
Next question. What do you think future hold beside mega cities? Because when you look at cities, it's always talking about these mega cities like Boston, New York and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. It's whole corridors. Do you think smaller cities like 300,000 to under a million, what do you think about them? Do they get to develop more, or do you think they will implode like Detroit?
Well, Detroit was 2.1 million when it started imploding. Yeah. So it's more a regional thing than the size of the city. And in the U.S., there are lots of medium-sized cities that are really powerful places, like Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And those are in places where cities are really imploding. So it's but those are also university towns. And, you know, so it all depends on what kind of economic basis you have. I think you're seeing that in Germany also. I mean, a place like Karlsruhe is doing fairly well. But if you go a few miles away to Pimmerson, it's a totally different thing. So it's really about the regional, the type of economic base. And a lot of these cities that are doing better are university places, you know, part of the knowledge-based economy.
In your point of view, cities where you have a knowledge-based policy or knowledge-based economy is better for the city than
well, in the last several years, that's been the case, but who knows what the future holds. Yeah. And I mean, it's partly about government policies. Yeah, the East, cities like Leipzig and Dresden are doing okay. And I think partly that's also industrial, right?
They used to be industrial. They had really big problems in the 90s because the people were moving out.
Yeah.
And in the last 10 years, years or something like this, this whole thing switched, mm-hmm. and now they're growing.
Yeah.
Because, for one thing, they're university cities, mm-hmm. and they had to rebuild their totally their economic profile.
Yeah.
It's really some work that went into it. They had, a claim, Leipzig had a claim, which was Leipzig kommt, which means Leipzig is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And as inhabitants, we were always like, where to? And now, 10 years later, we're thinking, okay, so they did well.
Yeah. It's going in the right direction.
Yeah, they were going in the right direction. Exactly. So what's it for France? What do you think?
I have to say that I completely agree with New Romano. I completely agree with your rep and with answer. And there's a question of economic and adding this shift, because also in France we observe that cities did it.
Yeah.
Some old industrial cities did it, and some other are having difficulties.
So it's mainly you need a mayor or a city council that has a vision for the city.
That certainly helps to have a vision. I mean, it doesn't always work out, but it's certainly important that you have a sense of where you want the city to go and what strengths do you want to build on.
So it's the most important to have a vision.
Yeah, definitely.
So what I learned from this is that we shouldn't exactly, when you look at cities, we shouldn't look at mega cities so much, but more the second tier, so smaller cities where it's happening.
Yes, and I think of mega cities, I don't really think of European or American cities. I really think of Shanghai, Mumbai, and places like that. Mega cities and the concentration on the top rank cities can sometimes have suck out a lot of energy from other places. But I think smaller cities are really, really important also in terms of the overall economic strength of a country and the social life of a country, yeah.
What creates a good city for you to live in? What's important for you?
For me, a city is really about the people and about the social and the activities that go on there. So it's about the comfort of living there. It's about the convenience of living there. It's about having vibrancy in terms of lots of activities, people around, in terms of the diversity of people and things. So all of those things are important to me. But also, I mean, just the physical environment that is comfortable, that are attractive. I mean, all of those things are places that you can get away from the pressure of people at the same time being around people. So all of those kinds of things are, to me, are what makes cities. And the vision that we have seen, like you remember, you mentioned the Le Corbusier vision, that was in opposite direction from what I think of as good cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these mega buildings, huge empty plazas, because that's what they eventually became. All of those things are antithetical for me to what mm-hmm. makes a city work.
So you like more the hustle and bustle of people?
The places where you have human scale businesses, that you can have some smaller places, you can have bigger places, you can have lots places that also you can get your everyday meat stuff done. Yeah. You can get your grocery, you can go to the hardware store. All those kinds of things to me are important in terms of a city.
I find it was really interesting what you said yesterday, that if you have a walkable neighborhood, it means you have much more economic scale for this than instead where you have to drive.
A car-oriented place is really part of a mega economy. It's part of the chain of Walmart and those kinds of mega places, and it's just another part, it's just the end part of the chain. So you drive to the big mall to get the stuff that was delivered by trucks from all around the world. Whereas in a city that is more walkable, you're more likely to have more local oriented goods and services. And you have people who are not necessarily going to the supermarket once a week and they have a big fridge, but they go and they buy their stuff from the little greengrocer or the little grocery on the side. And this is what I really was talking about in Jamaica, is this idea of the type of transportation system you have determines what type of economic system you're supporting. In the case of my homeland of Jamaica, a car economy supports an import-oriented economy, whereas walking and biking is more tied to local producers, local middlemen, local produce, etc. So if you're really thinking about sustainability in the bigger sense, walking and biking is not just about keeping you fit and being cheap transportation. It's also about the type of economic activities that you're supporting in the city.
It seems at the moment that a lot more people want to live more locally, to have more local produce and stuff. So the city governments who want to further this notion, who want to be more sustainable, they need to invest in.
Well, they first need to understand the connection, that there is an important connection between the type of economy that you are supporting, the type of transportation you're supporting, and the type of economy that you want. So there is a synergy between the two things. I mean, a lot of times we talk about transportation as just about movement, but also about the cost and about the efficiency. But there are other trade-offs or implications from the type of transportation system that you have.
Yeah, definitely. How is it in France? Do you think that it's more localized, or do you think it's more as a general, as more import-driven? Do you think the city governments are actually working towards more active mobility, or do you think they are more getting into more cars?
No, the current transport policy in France are definitely working in the direction of active mobility and bicycles. And what is really interesting, I heard newly that we have a new policy or new rules in France. That means that in some cities, bike users are no more, it's not mandatory for bike users to stop at the red light when you're on the traffic flow. I think a good signal for active means of transport, because it's the idea that red lights were built for cars and not for bikes. And now in some cities, you can go straight or turn right or turn left at the red light with your bike. So it's really, I was thinking it's a nice policy and a nice switch of mentalities, because we recognize that red lines were done for cars and not for the other users. So the danger comes from the cars and not necessarily from the others.
You definitely have this problem. In Edinburgh, I've been there in September, and they have the traffic lights at Princess Street. They are totally odd from their programming, because if you're a pedestrian, and even so you could go, because they are not crossing, the vehicles aren't crossing your path, you're not allowed to. You stand there what feels like hours. And the funny thing is, if you come there first, usually stand there and wait for the light to turn green. But eventually you get so annoyed, so you start walking when your way is free. And it's actually, you can see who is new to the city, because they will stand there and everyone else will go. And I mean, really everyone. Mothers with children and their strollers and stuff like this, because I know the traffic won't go for another 2 minutes or something like this. It's really weird they have this traffic lighting.
I think you bring up a really important point, because traffic signals are really a symbol of who's on top. And if you bring up Zurich again, in Zurich, the priorities are the trams. So the tram comes to the line, the light changes immediately. The bus is second. But the other thing that I took me some while to understood was how they prioritize to help pedestrians. So the signals in Zurich are very short, so it changes quickly. So if you're a pedestrian, you never have to wait very long because this is going to change quickly. So, you know, the cars are going through, it stops crossing for the pedestrians. Mm-hmm. The signals are really important symbol of who has priority in the city, but also it's part of the bigger picture of how you design your street to tell clearly who has priority in the city. And Zurich does it really well, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, they do it really well. And that's one of the things that is really frustrating coming to German cities. I was in Hamburg, and that's not a city that is designed for walking or biking at the least.
I haven't been to Hamburg, but I know that in Leipzig they are doing a lot for that, and even Karlsruhe is relatively okay. They have some where they could improve it, and but I think it's generally relatively good in general.
Yeah.
We've mentioned Jan Gehl. Are there any other city planners or people that you should know besides Jay Jacobs, naturally, or Jennifer Zedekar?
Jaime Lerner from Curitiba. It's an important... So Curitiba in Brazil was the city that led to the bus rapid transit wave that swept the world.
Okay.
So in the 60s, Bogota, with the help of French planners, was thinking of building highways on five axes. And because it was a tiny city, it was about 250,000. Now it's about 2 million. So the idea was, how are we going to grow? And Jaime Lerner and some others, he was an architect, and they came up with a plan to build the city around bus rapid transit. So they would have these corridors. Instead of being highway corridors, there would be bus rapid transit. And he, over time, became really influential in how the city developed. And it's a really important city for a third world city, for a poor city, in terms of how it's planned and how it manages growth. And he even became mayor of the city. So I think he's really important in terms of urban planning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm always thinking, because we are talking about mega cities and rich cities and creative classes within the cities, and maybe the idea of Lefebvre should not be forgotten, with the idea of the right to the city for all population groups. Because when we speak about vibrancy, such a city have to be fun and so on, we also do not have to forget that there is other population groups that are not part of this economical success within the city, but that has also to be integrated in the cities. And it's not a theoretical contribution to urban planning, but as urban planning is really cultural, a cultural matters, then I would recommend to be curious and to have a look at the literature, the painters, and to see how a city from the different societies is seen. And it's really interesting. For example, looking at the French history, we can learn a lot about French cities, reading Zola or Baudelaire, or reading for Russian Pushkin. We can really learn a lot reading literature or seeing paintings, and it's also a way to approach urban planning.
There's a French writer, a contemporary writer, and she wrote a book, and I don't remember her name now, but the book was called The City, The House I Loved. And it was set during the time when Napoleon and his who was the city planner for Napoleon? that built the boulevard.
Ah, I know.
Hausmann.
Yes.
So it was set in the time of Hausmann, and it was the idea that this woman refused to leave her house, because we think of Paris with all these grand boulevards, but not thinking about how they came about by destroying huge swaths of the city and displacing people. Yeah. And that's what that story was about. It's a really very, your literature idea when you think about it, it's a beautiful book. House I Love.
Okay, because in Zola, in the title in French is La Sommoire de Beute, in German. Then there is also the idea, and in this book, there is all this speculation process that are really well described. So it's not the idea of a woman refusing to leave his house, but yes, the speculation process, because you're right, Paris is beautiful, but the process to build Paris was not so beautiful. There was strong critics against this policy, which was quite brutal. Pretty much tabula rasa.
And I must say that I'm not as fond as Paris as most people are. So I don't take it for granted that Paris is beautiful, because that's not necessarily. I mean, Paris is attractive, but those grand boulevards also mean really big streets that are filled with cars.
and the traffic around the Arc de Triomphe is quite strange.
To say the least.
It's almost like a surf.
This was episode 4 of European Urbanism. I hope you enjoyed it. The music was, like always, from Erwin Schmidt. And the next episode you will hear here. You will hear here next month on the same streaming device, hopefully. And so, see you soon.